You're listening to the Thank God for Nostra podcast.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Thank God for Nostra podcast. My name is John, also known as Hoddlebod, and I'm here today with C.R. Wiley. Thank you for joining me, Chris.
Yeah, John, I'm glad to be here.
The pleasure is all mine. You have introduced yourself a million times on your podcast, so I'll try to introduce you sufficiently. C.R. Wiley is a pastor serving a church in the Pacific Northwest and is a senior editor at Touchstone Magazine. But that's enough about him, as he always says. And if anyone thinks that I sound a little bit starstruck, it's because I am. C.R. Wiley is the host of the one of the three hosts of the Theology Pugcast, and which is pretty much my favorite podcast. So if anyone's listening, you should go and check that out. There's lots of really good stuff there.
Yeah, well, thanks, John, for thinking about us.
Absolutely. So today I want to, I think one of the areas that your thought has been most in the last few years, it seems like, is on work, on redignifying work and trying to reclaim it from a sort of technological milieu where it's been where our human work has been instrumentalized, potentially would be one way to put it. So we'll kind of focus on that topic and move from work into technology and from technology into some credenda. So to start with, I wanted to ask what, in your words, is the meaning of our work, both as humans and as well as Christians? And a particular angle that I'd like to approach that from is work meant primarily to form us or to form the world around us? So, you know, of course, when you do a particular kind of work, you accumulate skill, you accumulate virtue, you shape your soul through that exercise. So, or is it a mix of both, as it often usually is?
Well, yeah, it's certainly both. I think you picked up on the thing that most people miss, and that is how it shapes us. When it comes to work, you know, you've just talked to people on the street, they'll say, well, I need a job to pay the bills, you know, it's pretty straightforward. But if you were to ask, you know, a series of leading questions like why, it wouldn't be hard to take a person down a trail that eventually lands at happiness, which is what Aristotle said is really the object of all of our action. You know, we're that's the telos. Now, in terms of what we as Christians think, that's fine as far as it goes, but it doesn't go far enough. And what we believe is that ultimately our telos is in God, and that's our true happiness. But we find our joy in his glory. There's that marvelous first question in the Westminster Shorter Catechism, what's the chief end of man? And that's to glorify God and enjoy him forever, which is fun because you've got two answers for one question, but they're actually two sides of the same coin. So they're both true. And they really kind of have to be both true at the same time if we're made for God's glory and we find our fulfillment in that. It's evidence that God made us for that we're joyful when we you know, pursue that. So when it comes to work and how, you know, we can think about it, one way to think about it, if we get beyond just kind of the immediate needs that we all feel for food and shelter and so forth, it gets to what you were talking about before, shaping the world, making things. And there's a sense in which, again, that's a reflection of God's image in us. He's a maker, we are makers. He can make a universe out of nothing. We have to work with something. So whatever we make is based on what he's already made. But we're, you could say, elaborating on it, teasing out the themes, just different ways to think about it. You can think about it artistically. You can think about it just kind of in a utilitarian and practical sense. And then when it comes to what it does for us, you noted some really important things. One is work can be a school of virtue, but it also is beneficial in a number of ways. One of the ways is that it gives our lives a sense of purpose. As we work, we're serving others as well as ourselves, and we're serving God. So it's a really important feature to vocation, is that through our vocations, we're serving people. Now, sometimes people don't think in those terms because they're thinking, again, kind of they monetize everything and they think in terms of the exchange that's occurring. But in any given exchange, if it's happening in the right way, both parties are enriched. It's not as though one party is impoverished and the other party benefits. If that happens, then there's a term for that. That's called theft. So everybody in the right kind of exchange, both parties are enriched. So we're serving each other, as we make these exchanges. We have to reinforce those exchanges with laws and norms and so forth, because we live in a fallen world and people do cheat. But if we weren't in a fallen world, we'd still exchange. There would still be an ongoing, it's not as though we would all just be kind of completely self-sufficient, wouldn't need anybody else. So there would be an ongoing enrichment that occurs through our exchange and our gift giving to each other. So I think all of that is in play. And you noted virtue. When we think about things like delayed gratification, thinking ahead, planning, developing the skills required to carry out the work, to do it well, those sorts of things. Those are all in play too. So we're shaped in the process. I think this is often, I sort of hinted at this earlier, but I think this is where most of the time people fail to appreciate how our actions shape ourselves. And if we have that in mind, if we're keeping track of that, then the tools we use even will be something to consider. Sometimes when people say, oh, it's just a tool, I think, okay, can tools be dangerous? Or are they just do whatever we tell them to do? Has anyone ever been hurt by a tool? Has anyone used a tool and hurt somebody else? Has anyone ever used a tool and hurt himself? Of course, it's obvious, I come from Western Pennsylvania, where there are lots of men with 9 fingers. The reason they have only 9 fingers is they lost a finger in some heavy machinery. So yeah, I mean, it's just a tool, but again, there's a kind of naive kind of subject object, one unidirectional approach to thinking about our relationship to our work.
Yeah. And that leads nicely into technology, because technology is really, I don't know, there's lots of shades of difference and I haven't been able to internalize them that well yet, but it's basically no different from a glorified tool. A tool is an extension of human agency, and technology, even, systems, technique, the sort of higher order tools, they're really extensions of human agency. And they are, there's a couple of different views on that. There's kind of the Jacques Ellul approach, which is these technologies take on a life of their own and then start to form us, and we become subject to them. And then there's, I'm not sure if this is exactly what Heidegger was saying, but I was reading another book citing Heidegger when he was saying, no, like technique, technologies, systems, they're irreducibly results of human action. And so humans still have agency even within systems that are much, much bigger than us. I think there's a sense that our human agency has become increasingly alienated from the meaning of our work, like you were talking about. Our work is increasingly abstracted, compartmentalized, and so in a certain sense is not as, it doesn't involve the whole person in quite the same way. How would you like reconcile that dilemma as far as technological determinism versus the neutrality of technology and the primacy of human agency?
Well, I think human agency always is in play, but you can still acknowledge the significance of the kind of the feedback that you're getting as you're interacting with different things. So, for example, we've learned that social media has had a really detrimental effect on an entire generation of people. It's becoming more and more evident as time passes. John Haidt, he wrote a book here recently entitled, I think it's The Anxious Generation, and he'd pretty thoroughly documented that we've damaged an entire generation of people through a tool. And even down to the way the brain is wired. Yeah, this is something Heidegger wouldn't have had any understanding of because he, you know, did his work before we could do brain scans and stuff. So there is we're physically, even if you think about people in the past who were engaged in heavy manual labor, it took a tremendous toll on their bodies. Many guys died young. So there are just realities, it's not unidirectional, but I do think that we still have the power to work in the with the technology that we have, and it requires discipline. It requires a purposefulness. We can't allow ourselves just to be kind of carried along by our desires or our things that tempt us. I think we have to be more consciously aware of how we're using whatever the tool is that we're using to make certain that we're using it in a way that really enriches us and other people. And this is, pretty common sense. If you're on a riding lawnmower and your kids are in the yard, it alters the way you go about mowing the grass. Right? I mean, you just don't just go straight ahead and just roll right over the kids and say, well, hey, if things happen. No, you realize, okay, this is a device that can cause a lot of damage. So, it's mowing the grass, but, even as you're mowing the grass, you're probably killing hundreds of insects as you're going along. And, this is kind of the way of things. And so I tend to think if we err on, in any way with our approach to technology, it's more along the lines of the naive sort of unidirectional way of thinking about it. I come across this all the time. It's just a tool. It's just a tool. And I was like, okay, define a tool. And then the person just can't talk anymore. They just, they don't even know what a tool is. They can't even define it. It's kind of like, I know it when I see it, but do you really understand it? So even think of something as simple as a hammer. You can really hurt yourself. I used to be a framer. I can't tell you the number of times I hit a thumb with a waffle head, on a cold day. Man, that would hurt. And I'd do it repeatedly sometimes. Two or three times in a row, I was just like, I got to sit down, gather myself, figure out how to operate this thing again. So, but when you become really good with a hammer, obviously your hand-eye coordination improves, your arm strength increases, but you're also a more productive person. You've got a skill that people are willing to pay you to use, and you've got something you can give if you want. If you want to do things for people. I built a deck for my wife's grandmother when we were newly married, and I didn't even charge her. It was just kind of a gift, it was something to do for her.
Yeah. And by giving that gift, you're leveraging your work for the purpose of relationship, for glory, really. We can do things in such a way that we're subsisting, we're surviving, or we're doing work to please ourselves. But the moment that work enters into sort of a communal context, it's transformed sort of elevated beyond just the stuff of what actually has happened. And I'm curious, what kind of levers do you see for learning how to use the hammer that is specifically digital and social media? You know, we have this hammer, and in a lot of ways, it does what we're talking about because it is a social thing. It elevates these, you know, the content that we're talking about right now. We could have this conversation, but instead we're presenting it to other people, and it changes the nature of the conversation itself. At the same time, you know, that overconnectedness sort of erodes a lot of more organic or substantial or meaningful relationships. So, you know, there's a book I read last year called Digital Liturgies that sort of does this for the individual. But, you know, what are your thoughts on how individuals and society as a whole can sort of wield these new technologies of, you know, in Nicholas Carr, he talks about it as liquefaction. It liquefies humanity. How can we do that better, in your opinion?
Well, I do think we have to exercise a lot of self-control and be aware of the consequences of our presence online and our actions. I think over the course of the last decade or more, I think it was about 2008 when social media really took off, and this, you know, and the first iPhone became you know, common and used by lots of folks. So it's been that long that, you know, I've had a chance to think about this. So over 15 years. And early on, I just wasn't really very conscious of anything apart from kind of what I was thinking and feeling at the moment. and that led to all kinds of unfortunate developments. And, you know, I think a lot of people can relate to this, you know, like you say something that you later wish you hadn't said, just because you didn't think about where it could go or who might read it or whatever. And you say to yourself, you know, I didn't really intend to hurt that person's feelings. I was just saying what was on my mind at the moment. And so you can get, it's a solipsistic kind of experience when you're just sitting in front of a computer and you just, you know, you may be connecting with thousands of people, but you feel like you're all alone. So you're just kind of saying whatever stupid thing comes into your head. And so there's that. I also think, you know, we have to make certain that we're kind of not living for the avatar that we're trying to create of ourselves online. So I think there needs to be a simple and honest approach to things. Like right now, when I go on Instagram, I'm not sure I actually am seeing people as they are. I think, you know, much of the time they're being altered digitally, and you know, who are these people? are they even real? You know, so I think there's that. I think, you know, in terms of the time and how it can interrupt family life and stuff like that. That's another thing to consider. Now, there's the upside, you know. So, you know, I live on the West Coast now, part time. I still have a home on the East Coast, and I go back and forth. But I've got family in different parts of the country, and I'm able to interact with them almost on a daily basis, and that's a blessing. But the other side of that is, would I have moved if I didn't think I could do that? You know what I'm saying? You know, there's. So this is it's introduced a new dimension to our relationships and how we think about them. Whereas in the old days, you know, let's say you were in the old country and you were getting on a steamer to come to the United States, that was probably the last time you were going to see those people. It was like goodbye forever. So that was a pretty significant break. You know, we don't ever think about making breaks like that unless we just don't like somebody and don't want to talk to them anymore. You know. So I think that social media and digital stuff provides us with a lot to reflect on, and I think discipline and reflection are really important for using the technology well. We're entering into, you know, a whole new field of a kind of experience with artificial intelligence and what that could mean. For us, we're already dealing with it. I mean, so it seems like it's ubiquitous already in some more benign forms. But if what I've been told is true, there's going to be all sorts of stuff happening in the near future, like in the next 5 years, that's almost impossible for us to anticipate.
Yeah, AI is a funny topic because, you know, in every book written in the last 3 or 4 years, everyone has a chapter about AI. And I always find it the most boring chapter in every book because everyone already kind of agrees what they think on AI. There's a few different paths that we might go down, a few different ideas, but at the same time, no one actually knows what AI is. It's this interesting phenomenon of not being able to understand the moment that we're in, and, you know, much less anticipate what's coming.
Right.
We barely even understand what's happened in the past. You know, like Marshall McLuhan points us out in Understanding Media. He's trying to understand what's going on in the 1960s, and it's still revolutionary to us in 2020s. Yeah. You know, the things that are happening in 2025, we're not going to understand that until 2100, potentially. Mm-hmm. Like it's going to be a long way out, especially with something the magnitude of electricity or of AI.
Now, related to that, you know, McLuhan is an interesting guy to think about. He was very insightful. So, yes, you know, the world he's talking about is swirling around, you know, and everybody's sort of being carried along by its eddies and currents. But he had enough insight to identify some things that even to this day, we are thinking about and saying, you know, that's really right. he was onto something. He saw something. I just wish more people read McLuhan, or Lowell, or Postman. The thing that frustrates me when I talk to people, who are well-meaning people, but nevertheless really naive about this kind of stuff, is they just have no curiosity. They think they understand the stuff that they're working with, and then you ask them a few questions, and you realize they know almost nothing about it. They're giving their lives over to this stuff, and they don't understand it at all. It's just kind of startling. You know, if you just read a Lowell on technology, you know, you'd be much more guarded in terms of how you think about it, use it, all that kind of stuff. And then you'd also see that there are a range of things that we don't consider technology that are, because, you know, he talked about technique. Postman did this too, talking about language. Language is technology. You know, we tend to think in terms of, you know, electronic gizmos, but it's any kind of systematized approach to, you know, getting work done or making or accomplishing something or organizing people and trying to, you know, like you think about, you know, Roman legionnaires, you know, the reason why they were so effective is that their technology, their techniques for projecting force were better than their adversaries, right? That's why they won.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thread to pull on because, you know, a lot of things that aren't, we don't think of as technology have those technological aspects. You know, you have rituals and rites within culture have a sort of technological aspect to them.
Oh, yeah.
Even religions, like you said, language, poetry, a lot of these things that we think of as arts or as qualitative have that quantitative dimension to them. So, you know,
well, I would say, sorry to interrupt you, John, but I would say of the things you named, religion is the most powerful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the West, it was considered kind of like such a, you know, comparable to nuclear energy. It was so powerful that we have to figure out ways to contain it. Because if we don't, it's going to, you know, this is the thesis, you know, the thesis behind the separation of church and state and all of that and the wars of religion and so forth. Now, I know there's been some scholarship that's called some of that into question, but I don't think anybody would question the power of religion and its ability to motivate people to and direct them toward a, you know, a goal. So, you know, why did they build Gothic cathedrals that took like 300 years to finish? Is it just because they felt like it? No, it was religion, right? And we stand back in awe today, you know, at this stuff. And we think about, say, the, you know, the windows, the rosettes, and how remarkable it is that they resemble things that we see in mathematics and in even the natural order of things. And we say, wow, this is like an insight into the very structure of reality here that we have in this window. Yeah. And these are medieval peasants, you know. And so, an interesting book, a fun book to reflect on is Dune, you know, Frank Herbert's Dune, because in that book, it's like the anti-Matrix story, because, you know, in the Matrix, you know, there's a war with AI and AI wins, but in Dune, there was a war with AI and AI lost, and the reason it lost was religion, the Butlerian jihad.
Yeah, I've been trying to read more sci-fi recently because I've realized, you know, like going back to the McLuhan point, looking forward is so difficult, but sci-fi authors are able to look forward and anticipate what might happen. And of course, the number of things that could happen is huge. So it's really just, it's a way to train your imagination, which I find really helpful.
They were prophetic. You know, they were prophetic. You know, if you take, for example, Arthur Clarke, he invented the stationary satellite. It was his idea, you know. And if you, I was just watching an interview with Isaac Asimov from 1965, and he was talking about transhumanism then, you know. And the way he described it, you'd say, "Man's a prophet," you know, because he's literally describing what we are experiencing today.
Yeah, I think the best ones are, they actually do see what's coming, and they, you know, if they don't apprehend it themselves, then they inspire other people to actually go out and build the thing that they anticipate. To go back to religion as technology, you know, I think it's true that religion is a powerful technology, but to call it a technology only really elicits one aspect of what religion actually is. And so I think an interesting converse sort of question is, what isn't technology? And you know, what sort of being or what in life inhabits the qualitative side of things rather than the quantitative?
Yeah, that's worth reflecting on. And my conviction is that the natural order is not technology, that what God has made, has a character that can't be reduced to technique. I do not accept that the physical universe is a mechanism. I don't accept that our bodies are mechanisms. I believe mechanisms are things that we make that kind of simulate and parrot reality, but they lack the inner qualia. Now, there are people who are speculating about, you know, whether or not we'll ever be able to pull off, artificial consciousness. Artificial meaning that, you know, we've made it, but it's it possesses a qualia, a kind of an inner life that is in some sense like ours. And, you know, there's a lot of speculation when it comes to quantum realm and all that kind of stuff, you know. And, you know, you can do a deep dive on YouTube and get really spooked with all these, you know, people talking about, you know, multiverse and, you know, entities speaking to us from the quantum
consciousness,
that kind of stuff, you know. Now, I've got mixed feelings about all of it. I don't think it's all just hooey, but at the same time, I don't want to just kind of like fall into every weird theory either, you know. So I have a measure of skepticism that keeps me from being a sucker, but I'm open to all sorts of stuff, but I'm just not sure how we would ever kind of be able to prove some of the things that people claim that it's already occurring. Now, I know I've kind of gone down a little rabbit trail here, but I guess getting back to this whole matter of, you know, the qualitative versus the quantitative, I think that's a really important distinction. And a lot of people who think about consciousness or think about the distinction between human intelligence and artificial intelligence, they can't help but wonder about this kind of stuff, even though, you know, it's sort of like a third rail. If you're a scientist, you know, the saying is, don't even mention the word consciousness until you have tenure, and then you're okay. You know, because you don't want to like ruin your career. Because, you know, it's one of those things that it's almost like religion. Like, but the weird thing is like, you know, people like Marvin Minsky and Daniel Dennett, you know, they use their consciousness to try to establish that they don't have a consciousness. In other words, they're maintaining this kind of weird, almost Eastern idea that it's all illusory. You know, you don't. But then, you know, you have somebody who like Ray Kurzweil, and he's weird, but, you know, at least he's got enough common sense to say, well, if that's an illusion, it's the most precious thing I've got. And I don't want to lose it. I'd like it to continue. You know, so anyway, I've kind of rambled. I don't know if I've answered anything.
Yeah, well, I think you brought up the idea that the natural world is not a mechanism. And I think that's really helpful because, you know, that's not technology. Technology is mechanism. It's an extension, but it has to be an extension of something. Nature is, in a sense, well, it's a creation. It's something that God made, but it's not an extension of him in the same way that our tools are, because it's not helping him do anything. He's already omnipotent. So it's something that's created for its own sake. I was reflecting on humanism the other day, and, you know, kind of the Baconian approach to science. And, you know, humanism is the idea that man is the measure of all things. And if that's the case, then if we become the ruler, which can be used to measure things, then we ourselves can then be measured. And so we end up with a world of mechanism, which is then a mirror for the measurable part of man. But it's also reductive because there are parts of man that aren't measurable because, like you're saying, we're nature, we're creation, and, you know, we're more than that too. We have the image of God stamped on us as well. But, you know, technology as this system that encapsulates us is reductive. And if we succumb to it, we're reduced to something less than ourselves. We're reduced to something no longer complex, but merely complicated, inhabitants of a quantitative system. And so recovering the qualia is, I think, one of the most important things that we can do. And of course, that's done through thought, through work, you know, also through play. You know, I read a book a long time ago about hermeneutics, and it was saying that laughter is basically the taskless task of self-expression. So, you know, if you fake a laugh, you're not actually laughing. So you have to forget that you're laughing in order to do it. And I think those kind of like paradoxical formulations are, you know, just worth meditating on to hopefully escape this technological trap. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. I was just rambling, taking my turn to ramble as well.
Well, I think that if we reflect a little bit on the nature of creation, you know, Orthodox Christian belief, you know, maintains that God on an ongoing basis upholds all things. And if that were to cease, then they would cease to exist. So there's a sense in which, because that's the case, everything in some way is participating in God's being. So this participatory feature of the created order, everything from trees to rocks to people, is very different than what we see with mechanisms that we create. So, you know, we take matter, largely, you know, inorganic matter, and we, or at least dead matter, dead organisms, and we make things of them, you know, and we create things that are based on, you know, a pretty fundamental tech, general purpose technology like pulleys and wheels and things like that. And it's that fundamental tech that gets used in, you know, unimaginable ways, or an unimaginable number of ways, or innumerable number of ways, that makes the world that we live in, that sort of the built environment that we live in. But I think, you know, when it comes to the built world that we've made, it depends on us, but it doesn't have the same kind of, well, it doesn't, it doesn't have possess life. It's not, kind of moving along on its own. It requires us to step in all the time and do stuff. This is the thing about artificial intelligence that I think is, close, but no cigar when it comes to, our simulation of divine creativity. You know, it's artificial intelligence is a new form of general purpose technology. It can be used for all sorts of things, and we'll figure out uses that we can't even imagine at the moment. And that's another reason why it's just not another tool. It's one of the you know, sort of like I read somewhere that there are like 30 tools that are general purpose tools. Everything else is like single use. Like if you think about like the mechanical loom, it makes cloth and only cloth. And, you know, that's the way it is with a lot of stuff. But there are certain technologies like the pulley or whatever that get employed in all sorts of things, you know, and help to make other mechanisms or larger sort of systems of mechanisms work. And, you know, artificial intelligence is that. And it does have a self-recursive, self-improving character and an ability to reproduce. And that's one of the freaky things, you know, that we're going to have to kind of always remember is, if we try to shut it down, it often figures out that what we're up to and escapes and makes a replica of itself so that it can, you know, at least the replica isn't shut off someplace else. That's wild. But anyway, it's not the same thing as I'm looking outside right now and looking at the sunshine and the world coming back to life again, you know, because it's spring. And this is my 62nd time seeing it. And it just amazes me every time, you know.
Yeah, I love spring. Obviously, a more cliched thing I don't think you could come up with to say, but you know, around here we always have that first spring in early April and that second spring in late April, early May, and it's always surprising. No matter how much you remind yourself that it's not spring yet, it's coming. Yeah, it blows you away. I want to take this conversation in kind of a eschatological direction. You know, there's a few different verses. So 2 Peter 3:10, the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. And then you've got Romans 8:22, which says, for we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. Not only that, but we also who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption, the redemption of the body. And what I spend a lot of brain cycles thinking about and not getting anywhere is reconciling these two things and considering the importance of the created world as well as the importance of human work in sort of a I guess God's redemptive work in reconciling all things to himself. And I was wondering if you could riff on that a little bit. Like creation is being destroyed, so all of our work is going to pass away. But at the same time, we're called to do it. We're placed in these physical bodies. You know, God is not capricious. He's not creating us just to destroy us, even if he saves our soul. Like, how do you reconcile that spiritual heavenly dimension with that the earthly home that we live in, are shaped by and are attempting to prove, yeah, to improve. And hopefully, like, I think potentially glory is at the center of this. But I'll let you tell me what you think.
Well, if you think about that passage in Romans 8, you also have a reference to the creation itself groaning and waiting for its redemption. And that's secured by the revelation of the sons of God. So there's something about our future that bodes well for the future of the larger created order. the passage in 2 Peter that you noted is a favorite of a certain kind of a kind of frame of mind. I've noticed that people who are bitter really like that passage. You know, they just want it all to burn. And now, you know, we can think about that burning as an obliteration or a purification. You know, what's going on with that? I think too, our works, even though, you know, our works with regard to physical things that we make or work on, there is that melancholy recognition that we have that it's all just going to pass away. I'm old enough now to see many of the things that I worked on years ago falling into disrepair and so forth. Nevertheless, they live on, and this is an idea that I'm just suggesting. I'm not saying that this has, you know, a significance that everybody listening should take to heart, but it certainly encourages me. My works live on in the mind of God. So what's more real, the divine ideas or the physical objects that instantiate them? We're told too in Revelation that the kings, you know, of the world bring their tribute to the throne, and one way to interpret that is the cultural artifacts, the great achievements of those various civilizations somehow are presented to the Lord, and if that's the case, it seems likely to me that they're purified and perfected in the process. There's a marvelous story by Tolkien. I don't know if you've ever read Leif by Nagel. Does that ring a bell? So in that story, as you recall, you know, he sees a tree, you know, and he paints it. The question is, you know, what is he seeing? Is it just something in his head or is it more? Then he can't finish the tree, the painting, because of, you know, the circumstances that keep taking him away from his work. And then he dies, right? He finds himself on a long train ride and he spends a long time in a hospital, which you learn is actually purgatory, or not too hard to figure out. That's what it actually is. But eventually he gets on another train and goes to a place where he's got this beautiful, it's almost kind of like the Palouse in my mind. You know, there's this rise, this smooth hill that he walks up, and then he gets to the crest of the hill and he sees the tree. And he's, of course, taken by this. And Tolkien doesn't explain whether the tree is there because he painted it or it was always there and that's why he painted it. We don't know. My guess is for Tolkien, it maybe doesn't matter. But I think this was a story that Tolkien made for himself to console himself, because he was working on something like that, which was his legendarium, which is not, you know, the Silmarillion and all the lost tales, that vast body of posthumously published stuff. And he didn't have any sense at when he made the story, wrote the story Leif by Nagel, that any of that was going to see the light of day, because the only thing that had been published was The Hobbit. That was the leaf, you know, that Leif by Nagel was The Hobbit. I think it's pretty clear that's what it is. And he thought, what if that's the only thing that continues or survives, and it's in some, you know, dark corner of this museum, you know, just so the listeners know, there was this big painting that Nagel was working on, and it was used to repair a roof. And the only thing that survives is one leaf. And that's what is framed and put into the local museum. Anyway, I think that Tolkien wrote that in some sense to console himself, that even though what I've worked on may never be appreciated by anybody or known by anybody but me, there's another audience, a heavenly audience, and something of my work will find its home in heaven. I think that's what his hope is. And I think that's something that I take consolation in. You know, there are many things that I've done that didn't seem like they led to much, or I you know, felt like they were a waste of time or whatever. It'd be nice to be able to know that they had a future, you know, and that there was actually something kind of lasting that was the result of God's, miraculous work in purification and preservation. But again, I'm just speculating about these things, but it does tie into the eschatology, because, you know, this is what we're talking about, the last things. So I'm not a guy that takes delight in the thought of the world kind of just evaporating. I'd like to think that the promises in Scripture about all things being made new isn't just simply everything being replaced as much as it is everything being redeemed. So that's my disposition on the matter.
That's my disposition as well. I can't prove it, and I know that you can hew a little bit close to heresy if you get too attached to the world. So
sure.
But yeah, that idea that we present our works to God, that is encouraging. And I wonder if we could find an analog of work in prayer. You know, like, prayer often doesn't make sense on a cursory view, because why ask for anything if God already knows what you need? Why tell him anything? Why do anything? And in fact, you know, in Christ, the Spirit groans for us in our weaknesses too, in the insufficiency of our prayers. So, you know, even when we pray, that's God offering, sanctifying those prayers. But, you know, it seems like work has basically the same sort of structure to it. Our work is insufficient. It's temporary. It's also derivative. Our beings are derivative. God is not contingent. And so everything that we are is already in him, and comes from him, comes from his mind. And yet he gives us the raw material, the being that we can then shape to create something that is glorious to present back to him, the same way we do with our prayers. Is that a fair analog, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think those things relate. And when it comes to prayer, I've had the blessing of having seen answers to prayer, and even miraculous answers to prayer. So I'm a very strong believer in, you know, prayer and its efficaciousness. At the same time, it's awfully strange that I don't pray more, in light of the fact that I've had so many reasons to you know, it's so much evidence that it makes a difference. Here's an interesting thing. I just came across here in the past couple of weeks, and again, this is purely kind of bleeding edge speculative stuff, but quantum entanglement is a phenomenon in nature that has a eerily ghostly kind of sense to it. Are you familiar with quantum entanglement?
Yeah, I've read about it cursorily, right. Not too deeply, but most of the pop stuff.
Yeah. Well, the thing about the pop stuff is, you know, there's actually a basis in the science for it. and here's the thing, you know, Einstein referred to it as spooky action at a distance. So that's pretty much what it is. When you have two quantum particles that are entangled, what happens with one happens to the other, no matter how far apart they are. They could be, theoretically, I mean, they've not been able to demonstrate this with, scientific measurements, but theoretically it could be on the other side, you know, hundreds of millions of light years away, and it still does that, right? So this is where, like, Roger Penrose and all the thinking about the quantum realm and consciousness comes into play. The idea that when you think of somebody and they tell you that they were thinking about you at the same time, you know, and like you call somebody, you know, and they say, I was just thinking about you, you know, that kind of thing. Some people have speculated that that's evidence that the quantum state of our consciousness, and there's a relationship in there, and this hypothesis, that's evidence of it, that in some strange way, you know, we've been connected at the quantum level. But this what this does is it provides us with maybe a way to like speak about the way God communicates to us, kind of by analog. You know, there's something about our, you know, our spiritual lives that are in a very fundamental way connected to God's life. And when we're praying, often it's because we're being prompted by Him to pray for certain things. Like when I wake up in the night, you know, I'm an older guy and I wake up like three or four times a night. And so what I do to fall back to sleep is pray for people. If I don't go back to sleep. I don't know what it is. But all the people who come to mind, I'll just pray for them. And next thing you know, I'm asleep again. But I think that there's something going on there. Why certain people come up, why I'm concerned about certain things, that kind of stuff. Again, I'm just kind of freewheeling it here.
Yeah, well, I think so. I've, you know, I watched a video, an interview with Federico Fajin, who invented one of the first microprocessors, and he's now working on the theory of quantum consciousness. And I find that encouraging. I also wish people would just say, like, well, maybe the Christians had it right all along. You know, I've experienced the same sort of thing. And I wonder if that's what people mean when they say that God told me, you know, I see coincidences in my life two or three times in a day, someone will mention something and that can be explained away through cognitive biases and stuff like that. But really, you know, those are under God's sovereignty as well. So you might as well take those as Him speaking to you and then just pay attention. It doesn't cost you anything to go and, you know, read that book, the Bible that was mentioned or something like that. I'm reading Leviticus right now because a couple people mentioned that it's one of the best, their favorite books in the Bible. And it's not my favorite book, but maybe I have something to learn. So, and we could get into the whole, all the re-enchantment conversation here, but we're just about out of time. So I wanted to just let you kind of give a handoff to the listeners and, you know, potentially mention your book, because I think the book that you're working on about St. Anthony could be really, really helpful as just sort of a touch point in conversations like this.
Well, thanks. I hope it is. My approach when it comes to the subject of artificial intelligence is what I bring to the table is not technical expertise. You know, I'm not like one of the inventors of artificial intelligence or something. What I'm bringing to the table is some reflections on what it means to be a human being, and what we as human beings might need to keep in mind when we use artificial intelligence, because I think it already is unavoidable. I mean, if we're working in the, you know, modern economy, the contemporary economy, we're already using it, even if we're not aware we are. But it's only become more significant with time. And so what I've been working at is thinking about the challenges that we can anticipate and the spiritual disciplines that we might develop or should develop in order to use artificial intelligence well. So that's my purpose. And I do think, at least as far as I can tell, I'm the only person I've come across that's been working on this. I mean, John Lennox wrote a nice introduction to artificial intelligence from a Christian perspective, but he doesn't get into any of the, okay, how are we going to live with this stuff? I'm trying to summarize things that I've learned. I've, you know, read just lots and lots of books written by people who've been, you know, thinking about artificial intelligence for years. And, you know, I think I have a pretty fair understanding of the nature of the technology and its significance and the variety of ways that we're going to be using it. But I don't see those guys working at all on how do I make sure that So there, for example, there's the problem of containment. This keeps coming up. You know, we got to make sure that AI doesn't like run amok and take over the world, right? You know, so in order to make certain that doesn't happen, we have to develop, you know, varieties of way of different approaches to contain it. I'm concerned about containing it in my life. In other words, not so it doesn't take over my life, doesn't redefine me. I don't want to merge with it. I want it to do things that only it can do, and I want it to leave the things that I should do to me to do. You know, so I want to live with it and work with it. I don't want it to replace me, and I don't want it to take over my life. I don't want to merge with it. I don't want to do any kind of, like, you know, what Ray Kurzweil is proposing, or Noah Harari, or any of those people. But that's what I'm up to with the book, and I'm hopeful that I'll have it done by the end of June, and it'll be available in the fall.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward to it. And yeah, I mean, that's why I say that I appreciate you so much. So much of Christian discourse about modernity is backwards looking, trying to figure out what went wrong, or you know, pinpoint things that are causing our modern context. But we've practically moved on from modernity in already. And looking forward to these emerging technologies is it's a high leverage way to spend our time. Because these technologies are just so outsized in their potential impact and novelty. So it's a lot of fun to think about them too. So
yeah, I have lots of hopes. There are certain things I'd love to see it help us do.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to ask you another question, but I think that's our time. So I will let you go. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, John, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
It has been my pleasure.